Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, the shocking rise in cybercrime and the lack of legal protection for consumers in some cases. Plus, we'll hear about the multi-million dollar world of esports. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. We have a very busy show this week, so we are going to jump right in. If you have an email address or a mobile phone, the chances are you've come across phishing at some stage. As time goes by, these scammers are getting more sophisticated, targeting consumers and businesses alike. And this is where the cybersecurity experts enter the picture. Ronan Murphy is the CEO of Smart Tech 24/7, and he joins me now. Ronan, welcome back to the show. We're going to talk about cybersecurity in just a quick minute, but I heard you on with Vincent Wall on Breakfast Business on Tuesday, and you've announced some new jobs this week.
Yes, Jess, it's great to be back. We are expanding. We're very fortunate to be in a sector which is experiencing growth, because a lot of sectors are on their knees. So yeah, it's a very exciting time as we scale our operations, both here in Ireland, but also internationally.
For those who don't know, and I suppose you never really think about what a cybersecurity company does until you desperately need their services, but what is it that you do? Do you assess threats before they happen, or do you get called in when they happen?
We do a bit of both. The term cybersecurity is incredibly broad, so it's not just one type of response or a piece of research. There's many different moving parts in the overall cybersecurity service. And typically what we do for, we have different types of clients, but if it's a large customer, we help them move to the cloud securely. We help secure their remote workers when they're dealing with this new way of working due to the pandemic. We help them assess risk. We help them understand if they're in a specific vertical like, pharmaceutical or manufacturing or retail, what are the typical type of threats that are coming down the tracks towards their business. And then on the other hand, we deal with, smaller type companies in most cases where they have been a victim of some degree of compromise. So they may have been spear phished. They may have been a victim of business email compromise, invoice fraud redirection, many different really insidious, unpleasant type of scenarios we find ourselves in dealing with those type of clients.
What does spear phished mean?
It's a very targeted type of attack on a user. It's where, we're all familiar with the phishing attacks, mm-hmm. right? Where you get a whole pile of different emails, which is, it's mass phishing, right? But a spear phishing attack is where they will specifically go after one individual. It's very, very targeted. If you use the analogy of phishing, right, mm-hmm. For fish, normal fishing is you put the net out and you get as many as you can. Spear fishing is where you have a harpoon and there's one specific individual you want to get.
Okay. And that must be very scary, because any type of phishing attempt, and let's talk about the consumer for a second. The consumers, like, we get them all the time. That you still get the ones that are from a prince in some foreign land who wants to give you £1 million. All you have to do is give all of your information. And then you get the more sophisticated ones perpetrating to be your banker, your bank supplier, your energy provider, whatever it is. And they're getting more and more sophisticated. So if you do get something that's targeted, that must be next level scary again. Actually, as I'm talking to you, I don't know if I mentioned this to you last time, but maybe it was over a year ago now, I got an email and the title or the subject of the email was actually my password for, it's a password that I used to use for online services. And it said, Jessica Kelly, we have your information and your online password. We can tell that you use this password for X amount of services. If you don't pay, we will, put the details of your accounts out there. And I was absolutely freaked out. Now, thankfully, it was an old password, as I said, so it might have just been on a database. But I did get pretty freaked out about that, because the passwords that we have are kind of the keys to very important parts of our life.
Absolutely. And look, in reality, the password problem is the weakest link. Mm. So whether you're a small business or you're a mid-sized company or you're a large global enterprise, if you can compromise the password of the user is traditionally the weakest link. They're the easiest person to compromise. And if you can compromise a user, irrespective of how senior or how important they are, it's very, very easy to then figure out a way to take their contacts or their access credentials and make it a much, much bigger problem. So, you know, when you talk about hacking, right, sometimes, you know, people, there's very sophisticated global hacks which take place on banks and the supply chain. And, you know, it's real James Bond stuff. But the vast majority of this is as a result, I would say 99% is as a result of users being compromised. And that probably starts off with their passwords getting into the wrong hands.
And let's talk about this a little bit deeper, because say a lot of people, as you mentioned, there are working from home. I'm thinking instantly about people working in the banking sector or anything that deals with a large number or large amount of personal data, so customer data. Like, it's one thing having a password on your computer, but then you really do need levels of encryption throughout the device, and ideally not the same password, because if I get into your computer, that's one thing. But then if I can't access your files or any sensitive information, that's just an extra barrier.
It is. It is. And look, the reality is, and Jess, you know this and I know this, managing passwords is a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. And trying to stay up to date with all of the passwords you have for all of the different applications and systems you use is a real challenge. Therefore, you know, it's a good idea to have a password manager. And there's some really good ones, like, I don't know, Keeper Security is one that we use. But I mean, it makes an awful lot of sense to make that investment, because it is impossible to stay on top of them. And where people fall over is they use the same password for multiple different applications or websites. Mm. And that's where they get into trouble, you know.
What about some of the free password manager things? Are they worth the time of day?
I you know what, I can't really comment, because I never used one.
Okay.
But you know what, what's the old analogy? If you're not paying for the product, you are the product.
Yeah.
Personally, if it were me, I'd prefer to pay. Mm-hmm. They're not overly expensive. But what they're holding is pretty important. So, as I said, I mean, we use Keeper Security. It's fantastic. But there's various different products out there that do it. But I'd highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah, so it's worth the investment, basically, because it's protecting stuff that's kind of invaluable, particularly if you're a business. In terms of the level of threats, and the famous one, the most recent famous one, I suppose, was the WannaCry, which kind of shut down parts of the NHS in the UK and had dreadful impacts on businesses of all sizes. Are threats like that kind of constantly being caught? As in, like, the WannaCry was special because it got so far before we kind of figured out what was going on. Is it a case that stuff like this is always happening, we just don't hear about it all the time?
So in fact, Jess, I'd go so far as to say that we've had a very serious incident in the last couple of weeks, where a very large global software company were hacked. And when an organization uses third-party software, right? So inside Newstalk, you're using, Microsoft applications and other applications to do your job, right? Mm-hmm. Each piece of software you use is considered to be a necessary part of the supply chain. And what happened a few weeks ago is a global software company were hacked called SolarWinds. And it's pretty high profile. But what's so scary about SolarWinds is that they have a very broad portfolio of products which sit under their Orion platform. And while they were updating one of their products, the bad guys managed to put a remote access Trojan, which is referred to in our industry as a rat, inside in the software update. And effectively, all of the thousands and thousands of customers globally who were using their product, now suddenly there was a backdoor into the software which they were using. And now this was, it looks like it was done by Russia and it was state sponsored. But the fallout from this is incredibly profound globally for organizations as they try to get to grips with the challenge that they're now dealing with.
Well, that is mildly terrifying. We have to take a quick break, but Ronan Murphy of Smart Tech 24/7 is going to stay with me here on News Talk. And when we come back, we'll talk about what happens if you are the victim of a hacking.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. TechTalk at newstalk.com is the email address if you want to get in touch, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. Ronan Murphy of Smart Tech 24/7 is still with me. We're talking about cybersecurity. And Ronan, before the break, we were talking about how, you know, everyone's working from home at the moment. A lot of businesses are maybe trying out new softwares or trying out new ways of working as we sort of progress through the pandemic. If a business is looking to try out new software or experiment with a particular company, is there any way to audit them before you engage, or does that work at all?
Yeah, so here's the advice I give, right? And it's not going to be as sexy as it should be, the fact that, you know, we're talking about something that's cutting edge cybersecurity here, right? But if you're the bad guys, there's lots of low hanging fruit out there that you can very easily compromise, right? Mm-hmm. So all you have to do is be a little bit better than the company down the road. Because if you're a little bit better than them, you know what? These guys will turn their attention towards somebody else and put their energy into compromising those guys. And the problem here is that organizations tend to fall over on the basics. And the basics are educating their staff and making sure that they understand the risks of clicking on a link or putting their and not having good password hygiene. And those very basic measures, hygienic measures you can take from a cyber perspective. And that's the start. It really is that simple. That's the start. And if you get to a position where you have your basic hygiene in a good place, so you've educated your staff, you've got good policies, they understand the sophistication of phishing emails, that's a huge step forward, right? And automatically you're in a much better place than a lot of your companies in the same size as yourself. And then once you've that done and you can stand over it and you can say, you know what, we're in a good place here now, you then move on to the next phase. And that's where you start investing in new technologies and so forth for different types of collaboration and working and remote working. But the basics are often overlooked. And that's, unfortunately, that's the reality of the situation we find ourselves in. And one other point, actually, I think it's worth touching on. We spoke a little bit about phishing, Jess, and you honed in on what is spear phishing, and I gave you the example of the individual getting targeted rather than, you know, 100 million emails going out. But in the last week, we've been analysing a lot of the phishing coming out around DHL and FedEx and the various different logistic companies, because everybody's ordering online. Mm-hmm. And we were blown away by the quality. Absolutely blown away. I mean, it's as good as a phishing email. It's no longer the prince in Nigeria who's sending you, you know, $1 million.
Yeah.
These are, you know, there's a very high chance right now, Jess, that you've got something in the post from Amazon, and so do I, right? And suddenly, because of Brexit, there's a degree of uncertainty, and you get an email saying, listen, you know, you need to pay a tax for whatever reason, or there's some issue, log in here. And even the way they're spoofing the domain and the quality of it and the layout, these guys are getting good, really good. And mass phishing emails are no longer from the prince. They're now from DHL or FedEx or your utility service provider. They're well written. There's no grammatical errors. there's a very high percentage chance that you fall in to the type of target customer that the message is playing on.
Mm-hmm.
And the fallout from that stuff is incredible. Like the amount of horror stories that we're seeing every week from small businesses to individuals who are being compromised as a result is astounding. I mean, these guys are printing money on the back of catching people, you know?
Yeah, no, one of my colleagues here actually received one of those DHL texts and she forwarded it on to me going, does this look legit? Because again, I think she was waiting for an online order and she bounced the text. She sort of sent me a screenshot of it. And then I said, will you just forward me the exact message? Because I wanted to look at the URL and I clicked the URL and I spent, I would say, a good 10 minutes looking at it, trying to do the usual checks. You know, do they have the wrong colour on the logo? Is there typos? All of that stuff. Even, as you said, the domain name looked fairly legit because sometimes it doesn't always go to a www.newstalk.com type address. Sometimes they can be a bit of a mashup. And it was only when I put in a junk reference code. That's what I did. I basically made up a reference. It said, you know, put in your package number here or whatever it was. And I put in a random one. And then all of a sudden it brought me to a credit card page to pay for my fees for my non-existent package. And I think if it's proving that tricky for people, and I would say that I'm pretty eyes wide open when it comes to this sort of stuff. If I struggled with that, I could totally see how not even my parents, but my friends who are ordering stuff online would just be like, oh, come on, I want my new trainers. Let me just pay for whatever it is and move on.
Indeed,
and that's what
indeed.
They're relying on, isn't it? They're relying on that sense of urgency.
It's crazy. And I mean, these guys have got so good. They've got so good. I mean, their attention to detail, their ability to mask the domain, like normally, you know, how you're going to know this stuff, and you've just touched on it. I mean, you're very astute when it comes to this. It's your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'll click on the email and you'll suddenly see that the, you know, the orders at DHL is actually spoofed, right? They've masked it. But I mean, these guys are getting good at covering up all of the traditional indicators that this is a phishing email. Once they catch you, I mean, they know how to clean you out. I mean, they've got very, very good techniques. We dealt with a very kind of unfortunate situation 2 or 3 weeks ago where we had a farmer. This guy was just a normal everyday farmer, small farm in Ireland, and he was buying some equipment for his farm and he was buying it from a supplier in the United Kingdom. The supplier in the United Kingdom had clicked on a phishing email. The guys have got access to his computer. The farmer in Ireland was making a payment of a significant amount, a couple of hundred thousand euros, to pay for his equipment. And the supplier, these guys compromised the email. They sent on fake banking information. The money was transferred. The guy followed up to find out where his equipment is. And the supplier said, well, you need to pay for it. And he said, well, I paid weeks ago. And they said, we haven't got your money. They went checking and the money was gone, cleaned out. And that, unfortunately, now, I mean, the reason I told that story, we deal with lots of these and lots of them are very large monetary sums. This was a couple of hundred thousand.
Yeah.
But the money's gone. I mean, there's no recourse whatsoever. It's gone. And
how can that be the case though? How can, like, if you can trace the sort of security, the loophole or whatever you want to call it, back onto the company, does that not, like, does the onus not fall on them because their security wasn't up to scratch?
I was talking to the chief superintendent in the Gardaí fraud squad 2 or 3 days ago about this, and amazingly enough, there is no precedent in law that has been set that there's a duty of care from the supplier to the end user because their email has been compromised. It gets incredibly technical. I mean, I've had really interesting discussions with Queen's Counsel in the UK. With various barristers and law firms in Ireland about the complexities and the degree of liability and who that sits with. And, you know, perhaps the user on this side didn't pay enough due care and attention to the email to or double check it by phone or fax or whatever it might be. But you would assume, I would assume that it's cut and dry. This guy had his email hacked, therefore he's liable, he's got a duty of care. But in fact, there's no precedent for that in law. So it's a fascinating area, and it definitely looks like the law needs to catch up really, really quickly.
Absolutely, because it doesn't, like, the example you're talking about is a few, like, hundreds of thousands of euro. But I know if that happened to me with a few hundred euro, I would be up in arms and I would not be happy about it, because, you know, like, the whole point of the businesses going online, and, you know, a lot of people do paperless billing and pay online and all that malarkey, and it's meant to make our lives easier. But hearing that story, next time my bill comes in, I'm going to want to talk to a customer service representative to make sure that this is legit. And you're going to end up having more admin to do the convenient pay online.
Yeah. So I mean, Jess, I spent an hour debating the common sense of this with senior, Queen's Counsel barrister in the UK, saying this is madness. I mean, we've got forensic proof and evidence that the vendor was compromised, that their business email was compromised, and that resulted in invoice fraud redirection for a significant sum of money. Surely there's a duty of care. Surely they have to be responsible. And the law does not have a precedent for this type of incident set, which was news to me. I mean, I was stunned. So I think there's going to be some really interesting test cases of these type scenarios in the coming weeks, months and years, you know.
Especially now, like with COVID, for example, a lot of small businesses have been forced to move their businesses online to survive. And if they're trying to do that whilst not, you know, investing too much money, because maybe they lost a lot of money last year, cybersecurity is such an essential part of it, but maybe they don't have the budget for it. And if this was to happen to a medium-sized business, that they were the ones who were sort of, if it was their email server that was hacked or whatever, that could absolutely kill a business from a reputational point of view.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the sums of money are staggering, absolutely staggering.
Janie Mac. And so I'm actually kind of, my mind is a little bit blown about that, because I didn't realise that there's no recourse for that. And I always use like websites like Trustpilot and whatever. If I'm buying from a new website for the first time, I'll do a bit of research on it to make sure that other people have recently either said good things about it or bad things about it and avoid it like the plague. Is that the extent of what we, the consumer, can do right now?
So what I've just described to you is a little bit different. What I've described to you is where a vendor has been compromised and there's a transaction taking place. And I mean, this is a very common occurrence in conveyancing as well for the legal sector. I mean, the amount of solicitors who we see getting caught by this is astonishing, where somebody's paying the balance to close out on a conveyance. The process here is that their email has been compromised, and then there's been a victim on the other side who's followed very detailed instructions from the vendor or the broker in relation to the transfer of funds. So that's a very specific type of case, and the terminology is that it's business email compromise with invoice fraud redirection at the back end of that, and the funds being transferred to a bogus bank account. So that's a specific type of case. If it were a case where an organization or an application or an e-commerce store was compromised, then that's a different type of scenario where there would be more a higher degree of security for consumers if they're transacting in that method. But it's very different to the case that you may have just described, which is the business email compromise.
Yeah, it's definitely not cut and dry. Sure, it's not, like, regardless of whatever way you look at it. And I know you probably can't answer this straight off the top of your head, but in order for something to change, what does need to change? Is it the legislation that needs to catch up, or do we need to hear more of these absolute horror stories so that people are more eyes wide open and big businesses invest heavily in their cybersecurity, or like, what's the solution here?
So I think there's two things in that type of scenario I just described to you. I think somebody has to have the gumption to go to the courts. See, the problem you have is if you are going cross jurisdictional and you're trying to set precedent, the cost and the legal arguments that have to be built and put forward to a court are incredibly expensive. So to have the appetite to go that far what you're typically going to see or experience is that parties will settle. They'll just say, look, you know, we're not entirely sure who's right or who's wrong here. We'll just settle and we'll cut the difference, or, you know, I'll pay 20%, you pay 80%. And as of yet, nobody has gone the distance and decided to sit in front of a judge and pay, you know, huge sums of money to barristers and legal eagles to make a determination on who is right or who is wrong in this scenario. And that is something that's going to have to happen. Somebody's going to have to pony up the money to get that precedent set. In terms of the where cybersecurity is going, I hate to say it's only getting worse. The problem's getting bigger. The way we work has changed. The bad guys are better funded than ever. They're becoming more sophisticated. Users are adapting to, you know, new technologies and digital transformation and cloud adoption. So the term we use, Jess, is the threat landscape is evolving at a ferocious pace. And it's back to, you know, the very basic advice I gave at the start of this interview, and that is the fundamentals have to be done right. It's a bit like, you know, how do you stop COVID? You know, you wash your hands and you cover your face. It's the same with this kind of insidious cyber security problem. You change your passwords, you educate your users, you're careful about what you click on. And honestly, that's half the battle. And the people that do that, there's other easier targets for the bad guys to prey on, and they'll be successful with them. If you do the basics right, you're too much hard work unless unless North Korea or Russia or China or whoever it is have decided that they're gonna really target you for, you know, intellectual property or whatever it might be. That's a completely different conversation.
We might have it someday. But if you're listening to this right now, which obviously you are because you can hear this, spend some time today going through your passwords and do your digital hygiene, like you're washing your hands, you're wearing your mask and all the rest. Ronan Murphy from Smart Tech 24/7. It's been terrifying, but a privilege to talk to you once again. And I'm sure our paths will cross soon.
You too, Jess. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Coming up next, we'll explore the world of esports.
Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. We've spoken quite a lot on this show about gaming in recent years. John Riley of TheEffect.net comes in once a month or thereabouts to talk through the new gaming titles. And it's for fun for the most part, but there is a very serious side to gaming, and that is the world of esports. It's not something I know a whole host about, but thankfully I am joined now by Michael O'Sullivan, who is a barrister who specializes in the world of sports. Michael, you're very welcome to the show. You might just start by telling me a little bit about where someone from the legal profession comes into the conversation when it comes to esports.
Yeah, esports has mushroomed in the last 5 years, and the participation figures in online gaming alone in the last 10 years, I think the most recent estimates are upwards of kind of 2 billion people play online computer games, and there are over 700,000 people in Ireland alone playing online games regularly. The esports part of it then is competitive online gaming through organized leagues and tournaments with professional teams scattered across the globe. And it's a relatively new space, both as a sport and as an emerging area of law. So we're trying to catch up with it as well. As it grows, more and more issues are identified, and we're brought in then to give advice in relation to, be it online protection for the players or in relation to the partnerships and collaborations between the teams and new sponsors. So it would have been a space where you had endemic or built-in sponsors constantly, the tech giants, but now you see more and more collaborations between the teams and the publishers and huge global brands, be it Audi or Puma. So it's a really interesting space for everybody, but as it develops, more and more areas, more and more points of conflict arise that we're brought in to bring legal knowledge and experience to. So as they find issues, we find more areas to deal with.
And, you know, is it as basic as, or maybe this is a dumb question, but like what constitutes esports, and is there sort of a definition? Because I know the legal heads love to have definitions of things and understand what falls into this criteria and what doesn't. So does that come into play as well?
Yeah, it was that at the beginning. So there is a formal definition for esports, and it was all I had said at the beginning, kind of layman's terms. Esports is competitive gaming in an organized format. It's events or leagues organized by third parties for a specific goal, the winning of a tournament or a league, with clear distinctions between the players and teams competing against each other to win those leagues or tournaments. So that's the definition. So it's not just online gaming. Anybody can go online and play games, but the esports segment of it is structured either between the publisher, who are the makers of the games, or different federations. And there are a huge amount of international leagues based in Europe, the UK, Asia, South America, America itself. And now you get more and more global federations, which allow annual world championships to take place in all the different game titles. So when you're talking about esports, it's the organized competitive gaming between professional teams. And when I mean professional teams, I really mean professional teams. You have traditional teams like 100 Thieves or Fnatic, but then you've traditional sports teams like Paris Saint-Germain, Real Madrid. And here in Ireland, the only truly professional esports team is Munster. It was started as a partnership between a professional team and Munster, but then brought in house. So these professional esports players are treated as, because they are professional athletes. So now they have access to gyms and nutritionists and well-being programs, and they're being educated as to what they're doing, how their own physical well-being increases their ability online. So it's become very, very professional.
One of the things that adds to the professionalism of it all is the fact that there's huge prizes at stake here. This isn't, you know, you just get a little medal that you might get for Irish dancing. This is like, there's a lot of money on the line, and there's a lot of sponsorship deals on the line as well.
It's huge. So the two biggest world championships are League of Legends and Dota 2, which is Defense of the Ancients 2. And in 2019, the World Championships for Dota were viewed by more people than the Super Bowl. And the prize fund for the Dota 2 World Championships in that year was 34 million, which is five times bigger than the prize fund at Wimbledon or the Masters. So it's massive, and it's got a global audience of 150 million people. So it's a colossal space for people to get into. But your traditional global companies are still a little hesitant because they don't really know what they're getting into. Progressive companies see the benefit of it and the potential in collaborations because of the demographics involved and because of the numbers. So I think I might mention it earlier that it's estimated that there are 2 billion people playing online computer games, but Twitch and Discord and YouTube gaming were developed solely to allow other people watch people play computer games. And those viewership figures on those platforms are absolutely staggering. And because of that, you've traditional broadcasters like Sky or anybody else now have dedicated esports channels to allow esports to be watched through traditional mediums. So it's growing all the time, but esports has presented opportunities for a cultural point of difference, especially during the pandemic where we couldn't go to concerts or we couldn't go to sporting events. You had Travis Scott, the rapper, did a concert on Fortnite, but the viewership, the audience was 12 million people.
Wow.
So like you go to Crow Park to see U2 and it's 90, 100,000 people. You're like, this is colossal. But it's 120 times bigger on Twitch. And at the end of this month, Pokemon celebrate their 25th anniversary. And Post Malone is doing a concert. And that's expected to reach 20 million people on Twitch and Pokemon's own YouTube channels. So you're reaching massive audiences, and the demographics are different to traditional sports. So the partnerships work symbiotically for both, introducing each other's demographic to the other. So the potential is massive there.
It's a very clever business model when you think about that, sort of the cross-pollination of all of these different sectors coming together. What I'm really interested in is, so in traditional sport, a player will sign for a team for a certain amount of money. They will be loyal to that team. They will train with that team. They will be under the duty of care of that team. Does the same sort of legal technicalities come into it in the esports world as well? And what kind of money are we talking about if a player were to sign with a particular esports team?
Okay, that's a great question. And I have a very specific example that will come as a surprise to a lot of people, but will give you an idea of how big this is actually becoming. So it's an area that is trying to get more standardized, and the bigger legal firms involved in this space have brought esports into the traditional mode of creating the contracts and tying players in. But with that comes the potential for the transfers. So in November, December, during the official transfer window for League of Legends, Luka Perks, which is his gaming name, Perkovic, moved from G2 to Cloud9 for a transfer fee of $5 million.
God.
So all of a sudden, it kind of sets the standard. Now, this kid's a wizard when it comes to League of Legends. He's won the mid-season invitational, which is like the second biggest League of Legends tournament game annually. He's won it 3 times. He's won the World Championships 3 or 4 times. So he's an icon amongst League of Legends players, but it is obviously the biggest transfer in esports history, but it now creates a market. And with that, you get more legal involvement because you're looking at the well-being, you're looking at the protection, and you're looking at image rights that may not have been there before, and you're factoring in what you have in traditional sports and bringing it into esports.
And so, what are the challenges that can arise? Because, you know, it's again using the analogy of football. So someone signs to Manchester United, they live and they train at Old Trafford, and they're like very much contained within the geography of that region for whatever length of time. When it comes to esports, because it's something that you can do anywhere at any stage, you know, are there legal limitations on what games a player can be seen to play if they're signed to a particular esports club, that kind of stuff?
It kind of works that the individual teams are associated with an individual game. So they're almost tied to, that's their identity automatically. So G2 and Cloud9 are League of Legends teams, and that's where they're seen, that's where their fan base is. There may be similarities between game titles, but it's like the supporters of Man United and Liverpool. Like, you rarely will you find people supporting or playing both League of Legends and Dota. It's one or the other, and you'd be shouted at for saying they're the same game under different titles. They're not, and the in-game differences, while subtle, are massive for those who actually play the games. Because of the way it's gone, they're bringing players in-house. They are looked after as traditional athletes are. So it's not just that you have 5 of the best League of Legends players dotted all around the world playing under the same banner. The main attraction for esports is physical tournaments where you have the team of 5 sitting together on stage in arenas like Madison Square Garden, and it sold out for weeks, for a full week for the World Championships. And you have 30, 40,000 people on a daily basis paying to watch these guys play 5-on-5 team games. And so they're brought in house, they train together, they play together, develop the relationships that traditional sports teams would have. And from that the parent and they draw in. Esports is learning an awful lot from traditional sports in the sense of putting teams together and the importance of coaching and well-being. But then on the other side, traditional sports see how esports have developed their own culture unique to themselves, the mode of delivery, the mediums that they use, and they're learning through that as well. So it's really interesting to watch, especially the speed at which esports has developed and become part of the mainstream.
Yeah, when I was in CES about 3 or 4 years ago, I met with an Irish company called Design Partners. They're based out in Bray, and they designed and built the world's best-selling gaming mouse. So it's a Logitech product, and it's the mouse that enables PC gamers to, you know, play for hours on end and improve their dexterity and all of that kind of stuff. And I remember talking to the guy, his name's Cormac O'Connor, and he told me that in a few years' time, the money going into esports and gaming will be greater than that of the Olympics. Like, this is going to be where we see huge development and innovation when it comes to sports. Is that what you're seeing from your side?
Yeah, massively. And like, if you're putting it into scale for a comparison, online gaming in 2020 globally was worth $175 billion. So it's bigger than the international movie market and the NBA combined. So you're talking about a global behemoth in terms of commercial revenue. Esports then is obviously smaller than that, but it's still it's now a multi-billion dollar industry and growing all the time. And it's innovative, it's tech-based, but if you go to develop a team, and it was a topic that was discussed on a webinar we ran with the Sports Law Bar Association this week, the creation of a team isn't just about the professional athletes and the tech you're using, it's about marketing and innovation and your online presence and your draw on Twitch and your draw on YouTube and how you grow your fan base and make yourself unique and the point of interest or difference that you have. And yeah, it's astonishing when you get into the numbers and how quickly it's grown. It's gone from, I think, the Atari Masters in 1979-1980, where there were 12 people in California, to where we are now. It's just phenomenal.
One thing that I'm fascinated by in sport, and it does apply to esports as well, is the notion of doping or enhancements to try and ensure that you are, you know, performing at your best or the next level.
Yeah.
And obviously that comes into play when you are an esports star, I'm sure, because a lot of this is stamina, it's physical endurance, it's mental endurance, it's, you know, not needing to pee every 5 minutes. Like, there's a lot at play here. Is that something from a legal side that there are, I suppose, that there is a breakdown of what are acceptable substances and what's not, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So as it grows, the governance grows with it. And that's hugely important for the transparency and the legitimacy of esports. So you have Ireland Esports, which is a federation in Ireland. Trev Keane is one of the leaders there. But then you have the British Esports Association, the Global Esports Federation, and Esports Integrity Commission. So the Integrity Commission looks at in-gaming and looks at doping, and much like World Rugby does now, hands down sanctions for cheating or hands down sanctions for doping. And they're providing more and more awareness to players and teams of the dangers of overexposure and burnout, and trying to raise awareness amongst the players as to what will make them better. But the dangers of doping and cheating are at the forefront of the federations, and they're becoming more aware of it and putting more sanctions in place. And in-game testing is about to become a thing as well. So,
and what about like any type of product alteration? Because in that documentary I mentioned the King of Kong, there is one guy who was the world champion, right? And I know it's not the same, but it's an example. He was the world champion of King Kong, right? And he then got paranoid that the guy who beat his title had actually altered the motherboard on the machine. And so he basically dicked around with the technology to tweak it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how he got his top score. And it is so fascinating to think that firstly you'd even consider that, but also that people do it. Like, we see it in traditional sport where people mess around with their equipment, or they, you know, might change their bike if they're a cyclist or anything like that. So is there a standardization for gaming equipment as well?
There isn't a standardization for gaming equipment as such, but in relation to the cheating, the Sports Integrity Commission watch all of and record all of the World Championships or the Invitationals or the leagues or everything else. And there's a huge increase in the recording of the data and the in-game data. So the Integrity Commission in October twigged that there had been cheating in one of the Invitationals, where because it's streamed and watched online by so many people, there is the potential for those involved in playing to watch the stream as well. So the streams are delayed by 3.5 minutes. But because everything is online and unfortunately technical difficulties arise, somebody asked for an in-game pause because of technical difficulties. The pause ran for 7 minutes. But in that 7 minutes, the delayed stream caught up to become live effectively. And the person had watched the stream himself, taken advantage from knowing where everybody else was in the game, what power-ups they'd gotten in the last couple of minutes to see what the threats were to him and his team, informed his team. And this is where you're getting to, this is the level of detail that the governing bodies are getting into. That person was then banned for 9 months. He was fined, his team were kicked out of the Invitational. The result was reviewed, the other team then retrospectively won. And that's where they're trying to get to. So I don't know if that answers it, Jess, or yeah, is it a...
It does. And I think, like, what I keep thinking is that this is such a new area that, and we were talking earlier in the show to Rona Murphy of Smart Tech 24/7. And when he was talking about online fraud and hacking and phishing attempts, he said that, you know, the legislation needs to catch up, but also we need to start, someone needs to take a case to set precedent when it comes to this sort of stuff. Someone needs to be the first one to take an online, like in the example he gave, basically someone needs to go to court over that, and they need to finish it through, and they need to see it through and make sure that other people can then refer to that case in the future. And I'm thinking that kind of needs to happen in the world of esports as well. We need to start having the first screw ups and the first issues arise so that we then know this is how we deal with it.
Exactly. And like doing a show like this on the legal aspects put me in a difficult position, because you don't have the precedents where I can go, well, this happened in Kelly versus O'Sullivan. But there are a couple coming through. So you had a first generational gamer called Tfue, who was a member of the FaZe Clan team. And he got to a point that he became so popular that he thought that FaZe Clan were keeping revenue streams from him, or he wasn't getting his full value from his contract. And that was the first suit brought in the States by a professional gamer against his team to regularize the contract. But from that, the contracts have improved. And I think that was one of the things you're getting at. As the issues are identified, the solutions for the players or the publishers or the games themselves are identified and rectified. And during the pandemic, when traditional sports were paused, all of a sudden esports came to the front of gambling. And it was the traditional sports in computer game form, like FIFA or Madden or F1, where the rise in gambling on esports went through the roof. And they hadn't really anticipated it. And that's something that's now been looked at with the Gambling Commission in the UK, with the British Esports Association, and how you counter that. But one of the really interesting things that's come up recently was that football in-game betting has become a huge thing in football. But in a game of League of Legends, in a competition of League of Legends, there are 50 times as many in-game incidents that you can bet on when compared to football. So it creates a huge scope for gambling, but also for cheating or for tampering with the game as it goes along, depending on what's been bet on. So these are issues that have to be addressed, having been identified.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. We could talk for hours and hours on this. Michael O'Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us here on Tech Talk. And hopefully we'll have you back in a few months' time and we can talk through another aspect of this amazing world.
Jess, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast on the Newstalk app in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Fardy's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.